when you're working two jobs and living in a tent, when a house costs $1 million and you can't pay the rent, when politicians say they'll help but it keeps getting worse each time the landlord lobby pulls the strings of the purse, when the human right to housing isn't even part of the debate, you know you're living in a failed state. Millions of citizens are spending half their lives locked up in a prison for trying to survive. When laws must be broken just to have a place to stay, when the prisons pay the senators to look the other way, if you have to be a criminal to put food upon your plate, you know you're living in a failed state. You're facing climate breakdown when the trees are all on fire, when half the country's underwater, when a climate change denier runs the nation and the opposition party votes for oil rigs and pipelines. This is not so much a country as it is a corporation buckling under its weight. You know you're living in a failed state.
And good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland, live in the studios here in inner southeast Portland. And I have a guest this morning to talk about his new book, Red Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism. Good morning, Victor Wallace.
Good morning, Paul. Pleased to be here.
And I forgot to mention that was Dave Rovics, who is a friend of yours, and that's his new album, whose name I... neglected to write down, but I will put that on my program page, Wednesday Talk Radio at KBOO.FM. So, this book looks, as I told you before, it's to me, a very sane book in very unsane times. I would have been very excited 30 years ago. To me, in my doom and gloom viewpoint, it seems hard to believe that we could actually have a revolution of eco-socialism. So give me your your elevator speech. Give us your best to start us off. Your best case for why you think this is possible, not only necessary as we all know, but possible.
Well, that's really the whole book in a way. I mean, why it's necessary. I mean, socialism has for a long time been necessary in terms of social justice, in terms of having a decent life for people who are exploited and oppressed under capitalism. But now it's become a matter of survival for the whole species. And that's the development that's, I mean, it's new in the last few decades that we've become aware of it. Although actually the awareness of ecological damage done by capitalism, you can find that even in Marx. But it's just that in the period since World War II, the whole thing has spiked. I mean, the indicators of destruction of the environment have increased dramatically since then. That's shown very well in the book by Ian Angus called Facing the Anthropocene. I don't know if you talked about that. But so it's a matter of survival for the species as a whole, but it's linked up with the struggle against capitalism. You have to overcome capitalism in order to be able to make your decisions about production and consumption on a different basis, not on a basis of what can be sold and how can you make a profit, but rather on the basis of what's good for humanity and good for the natural world, good for other species as well, because we're all interdependent.
Indeed. Of course, this is a talk show. Give us a few minutes to get rolling here, but we do encourage and invite your participation, your questions, comments, to 503-231-8187. And I also neglected to write down where you're going to be this evening.
Oh, I'm going to be at the Rose Villa home, which is in Milwaukee. I don't have the exact address, but I wrote it down. You can find it if you go to my Facebook page. That's Victor Wallace, W-A-L-L-I-S. My Facebook page has a complete list of all the talks I'll be giving down the West Coast. Portland is my first stop, but I'll be heading towards Los Angeles, bus stopping along the way in several places. So please check it out. It has the exact address of where I'll be speaking tonight.
You said bus?
Yeah, I'm going by traveling by bus.
Awesome.
Yeah. Oh, I wouldn't want to drive alone.
Yeah. And it's on River Road in Milwaukee, which, of course, is just south of Portland, the next town down.
And it's at 7 o'clock.
And it's at 7 o'clock at Rose Villa. And what is Rose Villa? I've just been hearing about Rose Villa.
It's a retirement home. Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
For lefties, right?
Well, I gather it because I know about it because of my friend Michael Monk, who I think is well known in Portland. He's from here, and he wrote the Portland Red Guide.
Indeed.
Yeah. So he has very kindly arranged for my appearance there this evening.
Well, I think I see my new engineer Heather on the phone with somebody who might be writing down the address on River Road in Milwaukee for Rose Villa. So hopefully we will have that in short order. So you're going to be speaking tonight, and so what kind of before we get into the meat of this book, what kind of reception have you? How many stops have you made so far?
Well, this is my first stop on the West Coast, but I've I've given talks in Washington, in Brooklyn, New York, and in Boston, which is the area where I live, around Boston.
Uh-huh.
So, I've had a good response so far. Not massive, but it needs to build. I have a great sense of urgency about what I'm trying to put forward in this book.
Good, good. And we all should, and hopefully do. Here in Portland, we're sort of a little bit of a bubble in that, we've been sort of on the front lines of this fight against the fossil fuel empire in stopping a lot of major infrastructure projects. Unfortunately, the rest of the country has not seen the kind of activism, certainly not the kind of success that we have. But I don't think even here we have the kind of sense of urgency in terms of what's happening, especially, with the madness that's going on around King Trump. But, leaving all that aside, it's not like, administrations come and go and he's just another. Obviously, he's a symptom of something very profound. And I kind of like to throw this out for you, actually, right off the bat. Are you familiar with the writer Nafiz Ahmed?
Yes, I saw some of the stuff he wrote after 9/11.
Uh-huh. Mm. And his thesis was that actually Trump's election was actually the result of sort of this deep division within the capitalist ranks, sort of the dying dominant fossil fuel industry, fossil fuel corporations sort of desperately maintaining their power in the face of the new economy, the green economy, which I know you criticize, rightfully so, and I'd like to talk about that. But do you give any credence to this idea that sort of there's a sort of this, he's this basically this puppet figure?
Yeah, well, it's an extreme development, but which has been going really brewing really since the 1970s. I cite the very good book by Jane Mayer called Dark Money, which gives the whole background to this. She calls it the right-wing takeover of the Republican Party. But, the two parties are interrelated in the sense that the possibility of Trump gaining a kind of victory was dependent on the fact that the Democrats had not done what was necessary and people were frustrated. So the two parties interrelate in what I call a good cop, bad cop interaction. They're mutually dependent, and the Democrats' failure is what gave rise to Trump, and in particular, not only the failure to introduce the changes that were needed, but their active role in suppressing any attempt to move in the direction of such changes by the way they sort of sabotaged the Bernie Sanders campaign and so on. So this is the culmination of that whole process.
Well, listen up. Let's get it. We just have a caller that called right in right away, so let's go to that caller before we continue. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. This is Camilo. I have a discussion about a project that I think suits the aims of your guest, and that's the Portland Clean Energy Initiative. And this is, in effect, a socialist redistributive program that impacts the environment. It would take 1% surcharge on the largest corporations, about 100 in Portland that do over $1 billion nationwide, and use those funds to to benefit communities that have been left out, and those people who have been disadvantaged in this system, namely people of color, the underemployed, women, and people with disabilities. And it would do it by making that money available for sustainable energy, such as solar, energy conservation, such as weatherization, sequestration projects, such as tree canopy and community gardens, plus a jobs component that would offer apprenticeships for people in these communities to learn how to do these skills. Now, I know, Paul, that you have a criticism of this, that it's not broad enough, it's not systemic, it's not global. But think about how Medicare got established in Canada from one state, Saskatchewan, to the entire country. And we know that there are at least 20 different cities, if this passes in Portland, that will imitate this. And you made the point, will other cities recognize what Portland contributes? And the answer is yes, they're waiting to see what will happen. So this is measure 26-201. We're having an active campaign of canvassing and phone calling. You can go to the website portlandcleanenergyfund.com and donate and volunteer. And once we pass, my goal is to take the environmental movement into the activism and join with other groups such as Jobs with Justice. And if we unite our forces, we can have an incredible impact in this region, and I think it will be imitated across the country.
All right. This sound, I don't know if you're probably not familiar with this, Victor, but it sounds like something that pretty much goes along with the, you know, the combining short-term and long-term activism and thinking.
Very much so, and I congratulate you on your initiative, Camillo. I think that's a great thing. I guess as Paul summarized, the point I make in my book is that we need a combination of these types of local initiative with the effort to build a political force, ultimately some kind of party on a national scale that can challenge and contest for power. So the local and the global develop in a kind of complementary way. You can't have if you only have the local, national forces can repressive forces will not be stopped, and they'll continue to encourage all the destructive development that's going on anyway. So, they'll rescind positive developments that have been made, say in the legislative realm, unless they're removed from power. That's why I use the term revolution, because it does refer to the need for a kind of change in the structure of power at the national or global level. But I absolutely support and congratulate you for the work you're doing, because it's an essential part of making people aware of what's necessary, and also giving them an opportunity to come together and become aware also at the same time of the larger problems that they have to deal with.
And of course, you in your sort of critique, what you call the first epoch of socialist governments, socialists, you know, the results of the first wave of revolutions. And you have, you know, we'll talk a little bit about that first epoch, because, you know, you have both critiques and also things to learn from them.
Yeah. Well, I think we have to take a cool look at the experience of the Russian Revolution and its aftermath, and neither exalt it nor demonize it. Look at some of the positive things that they did. One of the positive things in the immediate aftermath of the Russian Revolution was the whole idea of setting aside nature reserves. It was the first place to do this on a massive scale, and this is some kind. This is a progressive step, and I think also that to some extent the benefits of a social nature that they made available to workers, and especially within the enterprise and so on, they would and the progress they made in pursuits like public transportation reduce some of the pressure. On the other hand, some of the pressure against the environment. On the other hand, they did not get away from the capitalist emphasis on growth. I mean, they were in a sense trying to compete with capitalism on its own terms, and they got sucked into this process of sort of heavy industry, and I mean the militarization is all. It's hard to separate that from what they needed to do in order to survive, but the fact that they had to prioritize the heavy industry and the military meant that they did, of course, neglect the environment and the initiatives like the nature reserves, and so they were rescinded under Stalin later on. So there's negative along with positive, and we have to go beyond that. Above all, you might say, and this is of course what everyone points out, it's well enough known, they did not democratize the production process. They did not democratize the planning process. It remained bureaucratic. So a red-green revolution of the future would need to avoid that kind of approach.
Uh-huh. And if in your chapter where you discuss, the need for, really locally based, sort of decentralized, democracy in all aspects, including economic democracy, certainly goes along exactly with this kind of initiative that Camilo was talking about, and sort of against, you basically talk about the need to combine, a sort of a unified, national, global, whatever, continental movement with being rooted in local communities.
Exactly. I mean, because it's at the local level that one engages people, that people have to participate along with others that they know and that they can meet in a room with, and so on. So it's a massive multiplication of that type of process at the local level that's necessary.
Well, we do have a caller. Hold off a second, because I actually, it's Edie. So hold off a second, Edie. I have failed to introduce you properly. You're a professor of liberal arts at the Berklee College of Music. I actually didn't realize it. Berklee yeah. actually had other than, I guess they have to have a well-rounded education.
In order to be a college, they have to, yes.
Ah, yeah. So, and what do you teach there?
I teach courses on history and politics.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But you have a long academic career. I read, you apparently, we talk a lot about 1968 here, since that was the year KABU was born. That was your first year of teaching.
That's right, yeah.
Talk a little bit about how you got to that point.
How I got to that point? Well, I mean, in a sense, I was studying all along in graduate school, and I wanted to understand everything. I from a very early age, I felt really identified with the left in the sense, social justice sense, but I also felt an extraordinary frustration with the kind of inefficiencies that were associated with automobile traffic, getting caught in traffic jams and that kind of thing. That's something that impressed me as a kid. So I always had a kind of ecological consciousness as well as a social justice consciousness, and that I brought that with me from the beginning. And I went to my graduate study, my doctorate was at Columbia, and I was there in 1968 when they had the big ferment on campus. It was very, very inspiring. And there
Did
was
you get caught up in that?
I got caught up in it, sure, yeah. And so I from the outset of my teaching career in political science, I felt I had a kind of mission to radicalize people, and that's essentially what I've been trying to do ever since. And the biggest chunk of my career actually though was in what we now call paradoxically a red state, Indiana. I was in Indianapolis for 24 years teaching political science there in the commuter campus of Indianapolis. And so it was good to butt my head against the wall, because things are a little more friendly and supportive in the music school. But Indianapolis gave me a good opportunity to really interact with a whole range of sectors of the community, and I got into prisoner support activism there, which is something that I've continued right into the present. And it's even reflected a little bit in my book, in some of the description of the extremes of the present situation in the United States. You might say they're amplified tenfold, or even hundredfold, if you look within the prison system, the increasing brutalization that's taking place there. So I very much try to show all these issues in their interrelations.
And one thing, it's called Red-Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism, by my guest Victor Wallace, who you just heard. And I want to get into before we turn to Edie, our next caller here. So this red-green synthesis, it implies and say, and you explain, you know, what's missing from both sides, both the red and the green, and what both have to offer. Let's hold that thought. Let's get into that after we talk to Edie. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
I recommend that you read a book by Bill Moyer with Joanne Alistair, Mary Lou Fenley, and Stephen Sorsa. The title is Doing Democracy, the MAP Model for Organizing Social Movements. And so this guy who is working with Martin Luther King is looking at what he sees are the 8 stages of social movements and the 4 roles within it, and how we have to keep from being disillusioned and giving up, or in fighting among ourselves, or in playing those roles in a counterproductive way instead of the productive way. We have the normal times, you know, people only like, you know, up to 10% people are saying things are not okay, got to change things. Then prove the failure of official institutions. Maybe 20% are in the role of citizen and reformer, and proving that the system doesn't work. But in some cases, as with Camilo, we have, you know, closed down 7 fossil fuel projects with our testimony and our research. Or the 3, the ripening conditions, okay, now we've got Trump elected or whatever, 20-30% are upset. It's not just the takeoff period when you have the big rallies, the marches, the, you know, that something is happening, where you have the rebel. I mean, you have to be careful you don't go into the counter, you know, the negative part, but the positive rebel. And then we kind of say, oh, perception of failure. But all this time, more and more the general population is understanding and awakening civil rights, human rights, climate change, whatever. We may have 60-85% majority public opinion, and then we have success. This isn't a reformer, rebel, and change agent, but we got to continue ever spiraling and improving that progress. I really encourage that we do that. And again, as Camilo said, many of the advantages of the Portland ballot measure 26201, the Portland Clean Energy Initiative, is that it also is a way for us to counter and address some of the issues of houselessness, of injustice in income, of renter stability. Tenants are protected from being raised rent with the free improvements to the solar electricity and the insulation.
Let's hear what Victor has to say about the scenario you portrayed in that book, Doing Democracy, before we get too far away from that.
Well, I confess I haven't read the book, but it sounds like a kind of valuable how-to instrument for people trying to get active. I think anything to stimulate activity, to stimulate universal participation, which is what we need, is I view in a positive way. In terms of specific comments on the book, I unfortunately can't make them.
Well, it is a history a lot of folks did not have of the U.S. civil rights movement, the anti-nuclear energy movement, the gay lesbian movement, the breast cancer social movement, the globalization movement. So it gives people a lot of history that they may not know, mm-hmm. As well as how we can integrate that now. And one way we're integrating that with the PSEF is that we're having a disaster resilience and emergency preparedness, you know, that when the big power structures are, or Bonneville Power, Pacific Power, aren't providing electricity for us between the earthquakes or whatever disasters, we'll have homes that will have solar that we can recharge our cell phones or our generators or whatever, and that we're having ways in which we can take care of each other, or ways in which we're having moved towards public power and public banking. We're having ways in which we're getting independent of the poisonous food monopolies, and having our local food and healthier air, clean public. And we're having ways in which the 9 organizations, some of which are coalitions themselves, are overlooking this is a way of democracy and accountability, that our money is being used appropriately. NAACP, a coalition of communities of color, we're having the Opal, Verde, Apano, Sierra Club, Citizens for Social Responsibility, are overlooking this. And then we also have a way in which we're having, through 26201, we're having a way in which we are countering centuries of racism. The people who are first to get the housing and the first to get the jobs and the first to get the business contracts are those who are normally screwed, low-income, disabled, elderly, people of color, formerly incarcerated, et cetera. So
okay,
this is a wonderful way in which we're combining the intersectionality of social justice, environmental justice.
Great, thanks. Well, we've had two people call in on that already, and that's great. We do support that, and that's an excellent project, and we got a month to go, and presumably, hopefully, it will pass. Hopefully, people are supporting that. I thank you for calling, Edie. We're here talking with Victor Wallace, Red Green Revolution: The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism. So talk a little bit more about what I put out there. This, you know, there seems to be this historic divergence, tension. You know, on the most superficial level, you know, the fact that the remnant labor unions unfortunately seem to always often take the opposite side on these major infrastructure projects like the Dakota Access Pipeline. You had many major unions opposing this massive show of resistance, and so you've got this sort of historic tension between, you know, jobs and the environment, which of course is a completely flawed, and you maybe want to talk a little bit about it, but talk about what the red and green both have to offer and some of their limitations.
Yeah, well, the whole idea that there's a contradiction between jobs and environment is a direct reflection of the capitalist structuring of the options we have. That environmental issues are seen as a cost to the companies, and they want to reduce their costs as much as possible, so they'll be opposed to that. And they claim that if they have to pay those costs, then it'll come out of wages or out of production or whatever. So this is why we have to have a global resistance to all this. So the red part is really the struggle against the class structure of the society. It's a struggle to overcome the power of capital, and that's necessary to the green part in the sense that, as I said at the beginning, the only way that we can have as a society a discussion based on what is needed for the environment and for our own survival is by taking it out of this profit-oriented approach. So as far as the labor movements are concerned, I think this is an arena of struggle. And I mean, there have been some progressive elements within the labor movement. Interestingly enough, as I discuss in the book, one of the earliest expressions of a strong environmentalist position in the labor movement was from the oil, chemical, and atomic workers, which are a sector that's precisely involved with some of this energy. This is a great thanks to the great labor activist Anthony Mazzocchi. So it is possible. I mean, because they realize, the more conscious workers realize that what's destroying the conditions for life is destroying them as well. And
Plus, they come in most direct contact with the most toxic
exactly
substances.
Yes, precisely. Yes. So the environment exists everywhere. It affects the local community. It affects the people who are doing the work, doing the jobs with those toxic materials. And I know there are a lot of these terrible conditions. I hear about, you know, these workers, let's say in Louisiana, which is one of the most toxic states with all the petrochemicals and so on. They don't want the stuff to leave because they fear they won't have a livelihood, they won't have their wages anymore. But this is in a sense, a teaching point that there has to be the kind of organizing which points out that, you know, it's like having a gun pointed at your head. Are those the conditions that you're going to accept? And I realize it's very hard to put the demand to people like that, to people in that situation. that they resist that ultimatum on the part of the companies, but they're ultimately going to have to. It's going to be a matter of survival.
And looks like we got one more caller. Mitchell, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I have my question for Professor Wallace here. I'm glad you spelled the name W-A-L-L-I-S, because listening to him speak triggered a memory of probably the best book I've ever read in my 30 or 40 years of studying cults on Scientology. And when your Professor Wallace mentioned being at Columbia, it occurred to me that this great book by Roy Wallace was on Columbia University Press, and I just wonder whether your Professor Wallace is related to or was the Roy Wallace that wrote that great book on the dynamics within Scientology way back in the 80s.
The answer is no connection whatsoever. I'm neither him nor related to him.
Oh, because there's almost a parallel track about ideological movements that sort of go astray.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you very, very much, and keep on with your discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling in. You know, this, you talk a lot. You're obviously, your book, since you talk about revolution, it certainly implies the need to have some much more of a mass ferment than we've seen in quite a while, than perhaps we've ever seen since looking at the odds that are against us. And you talk a lot about the various tensions, the various obstacles towards getting some kind of unifying vision. And you know, putting oneself out there, as you essentially do, is sort of not necessarily a roadmap, but sort of presenting not even a program, but sort of a way of looking at, you know, a comprehensive or a more overall way that sort of has been in disfavor, as you know, you talk about in your discussion of like the postmodern sort of resistance to a grand narrative. You know, it went against sort of the Marxist, I guess, pretension to being a universal discourse. So there's all these obstacles, you know, the problems of like sort of identity politics, which tends to sometimes go against people all rallying around a common thing. So maybe talk a little bit about your own personal experiences. Obviously, this isn't, you've been dealing with these ideas for quite a while. Where have you seen sort of people really challenging themselves and really trying to work through some of these long-standing tensions, contradictions, conflicts?
Well, there was a lot of discussion of this, of course, in the 1960s. I was one of the organizations I was involved in at that time was the New University Conference, which came out in the late 60s, existed for 4 years. It was an organization of radical teachers and graduate students, and so we discussed
sort of like
a lot,
counterpart to SDS.
Yes, it's an older version. I was a little bit older than the SDS cohort. I was sort of supported them, but I wasn't directly part of that. But the New University Conference encouraged that kind of discussion, while at the same time taking stands on particular issues, especially as they affected the university. But tried to take a global stance, and it was a kind of multi-tendency organization. And later I was involved for a while in the New American Movement, which is represents a kind of similar tendency. So that's again a kind of multi-tendency organization, in the sense that I didn't feel yet that there was a clear enough definition for a kind of organization that would constitute the kind of political force I'm looking for. So I needed kind of a kind of umbrella, you might say, within which to hash out these issues, and while at the same time being active around various local issues. And I got very involved in local work in Indianapolis when I was there, not only around the prisons but also around downtown development and issues like that. And my training was in graduate school was in Latin American politics, so I did a lot of public speaking in the 80s throughout Central Indiana about the U.S. crisis in Central America. And then after that, I became involved and was for 20 years the managing editor of the journal Socialism and Democracy, which I strongly recommend to people. I'm still involved with it, but I fortunately managed to turn over the editorship to a really excellent successor, Suren Mudlyar. And this is, again, it's the publication of a research group on socialism and democracy. And we welcome submissions having to do with analysis from a Marxist perspective, but not necessarily from any single political tendency within that arena. So that's those are some of the kinds of things that I've been involved with in the course of my work, but underlying everything, and I think especially this sort of culminating project of this book is a sense of the extreme urgency of the situation, and the scale on which the change needs to take place. And my sense is that with all the extremes that are currently developing and that are evident to everybody in the debates that are taking place in this country now, it should be a terrific teaching moment. And so I'm really trying to encourage with this book and with my tour and so on for more and more people to get involved on a continuous basis in discussion of these issues, because ultimately the society that we need is going to be one in which everyone is going to be involved in the working out of the process. And I think that people often complain, and they say, well, not everybody wants to be involved, and people don't want to go to meetings all day and so on. And so on. Well, they don't want to take up their free time with meetings, but the meetings should be part of people's work time. It should be part of what they're paid to do, to get involved in these kinds of things. And there needs to be the kind of education that equips them to do it, and the kind of information that is necessary through what we now have as the alternative media that provides that. And also there needs to be, we need to think of structures, and this would be carry over into the eventual society that we're hoping for, structures to facilitate the discussion, to encourage people, and to, with some attention to, let's say, the individual reasons for certain people from certain particular backgrounds may have trouble getting involved in the discussion. So all these, recognizing all these different requirements of discussion and of action is part of what my experience has been about, and is alerting me to what we need both in our immediate process and in the vision we have of the future.
Again, you're hearing the voice of Victor Wallace, author of a brand new book, Red Green Revolution: The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism. And he's going to be speaking at 7 p.m. at the Rose Villa, which, again, I didn't get the address for. If someone out there has it, it's on River Road in Milwaukee, and I'm sure you can find that out easily enough. But I want to just let you know what's coming up this morning on KBU at 9. The Politics of Living features stories of women with no prior political experience who've decided to get involved in the upcoming midterm elections. At 10, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Oregon and beyond. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you have not yet, but you would like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. And there's many other ways of getting involved with a station. Go to kboo.fm and familiarize yourself, or just call up the station. 503-231-8032. I'll actually be at the front desk from 9 till 1 if you want to talk to me or hear more about KBOO or whatever. And the number to call in to join the last 20 minutes of our conversation is 503-231-8187. I wonder if I could ask our engineer, Heather, if she might be able to look up Rose Villa, the specific address, if that's something that might be in the job description. Anyway, so this is an inspiring book. I took a class called, it was a macro analysis seminar at Wesleyan University way back when, Mark Roseland something. Anyway, it was an amazing class because it had this complete holistic view of all the different interlocking crises, all the different actors, all the different kinds of resources, waste. Anyway, it was a kind of thing that really got me sort of being somewhat of a, I like to think a holistic thinker. And I think we kind of have gotten away from that kind of comprehensive. And you know, part of the legacy of Marxism, if you'll permit me, is both good and bad. I mean, the legacy was as like the most powerful, you know, transformative revolutionary movement in world history that actually engaged millions and tens and hundreds of millions of people and actually had real world influence. The negative is that it sort of did get sort of taken to be the comprehensive, totalistic, which is, you know, what the good thing about the postmodern critique was. It legitimately did critique the sort of the pretensions to being all universal, because there were, you know, Marx was a human being, he was a man of his time and place, and so there's limitations. So, you know, there's, you know, it's not just, you know, if people are uncomfortable with sort of, you know, this Marxist tradition, then there might be valid reasons. But we, at our peril, we don't try to, you know, deal with these maybe more superficial differences that are inhibiting us from, you know, tackling climate change and these, you know, the imminent destruction of our precious biosphere.
You want me to comment on that?
I do have
a reaction, but I don't think it's a pretension to encompass all these issues. I mean, that Marx was the first to develop a comprehensive critique of the capitalist system. Beyond that, he was the first even to see it as a system, as a historical system. So any kind of critique that we engage in owes its existence, you know, ultimately to that. And I think that of course one can recognize what may not have been seen by any given writer, including Marx himself, at the particular stage at which they wrote. But I still think that the framework that he provides the context in which we can address all these issues as they come up. And I'm round out my response to your earlier question about my own formation. I have to give enormous credit to Monthly Review, the journal, whose editor, of course, is an inhabitant of Eugene, Oregon, John Bellamy Foster, which I think represents a really seriously developing critique of the whole issue of the environment within the context of Marxism, and including demonstrating Marx's own awareness of the problem, how it was really integral to his work in a sense that people had not realized before. And so it does provide a framework within which all this discussion can take place. And I don't think the fact of its being a comprehensive view, or what the postmodernists derisively call a meta-narrative, I don't think that's a real criticism. One needs a comprehensive view in order to establish a framework within which people can come together and understand things and develop the necessary political force. If everything is fragmented, this will never happen. I mean, because the power system that we're facing, that's oppressing us, is a universal system. I mean, it encompasses every aspect of our lives, and so if we don't attack it in a way that's on the same scale, we won't have a chance at being successful. So certainly there has to be openness, discussion, open criticism, and so on, and not just blind repetition of what people have said before. But at the same time, this we do need to recognize the kind of framework within which this can take place in a fruitful way, in which there can be a kind of cumulative process in which we build on the experiences and the development and the successes and the failures of previous attempts within this whole tradition.
Yeah, you mentioned John Bellamy Foster. I believe in your book you kind of present sort of two approaches to sort of this red-green sort of a greening socialism. You contrast him with O'Connor, I believe. Mm-hmm. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Oh, just a little bit in the way of background. I mean, James O'Connor was also a very important pioneer, really, of the ecological critique. He founded the journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism. I admire both the Monthly Review and Capitalism, Nature, Socialism, and I've written for both. But in terms of the theoretical approach, O'Connor's approach was to, in a sense, see the environmental issue as something that would develop along a separate line. He spoke of a second contradiction of capitalism as though it wasn't recognized as part of what capitalism was doing to begin with. You know, he said, in other words, you had the critique of the class structure, and then you added onto it the critique of capitalism's approach to nature. And what Foster's position, which I think is better grounded in Marx, is to notice that Marx's critique of capitalism included his critique of what capitalism did to nature, and the whole emphasis given by Marx to the necessity to pass on to our for each generation to pass on to its successors the world in as at least as good a condition as it found it. So this is you know, it's a continuing debate. There have been recent books, especially a recent one by a Japanese scholar published by Monthly Review Press, which have gone into great detail in Marx's early work, bringing this out. Why is this important? It's not just a scholastic matter. It is a matter of the degree to which we recognize these struggles as interrelated and not as a separate things.
So, you know, we talk in this this Trumpian moment, but also, you know, sort of a Bernie Sanders moment, if you will. And of course, the he being a self-identified democratic socialist, and of course, the democratic socialists of America have been seeing a resurgence. And the word is that young people are a little more over this sort of rabid anti-communism, which kind of defined your and my upbringings. So maybe there is more openness to a book like yours. Talk a little bit about your own experiences, maybe with you know, as a teacher with younger people, and exactly what I was just saying about, you know, maybe a more openness to these socialist ideas.
Yeah, I've certainly seen that in the last few years at the Berklee College of Music, which draws a kind of a national as well as an international audience. In my earlier years teaching in Indiana, there was a lot of pushback against what I was trying to do, as you can well imagine. So that was a good experience, an important experience, and something we still have to deal with, and we mustn't neglect the whole mindset that involves. On the other hand, I did find there that with the kind of extreme sort of right-wing culture that existed at the time, there was such a blind spot, you might say, to any kind of critique that if you injected radical critique, there was a great openness to that. So they weren't sort of sidetracked by some of the spurious critique, you know, like especially the kind of thing that's taking place now where the liberal attack on Trump consisted in attacking Russia and that kind of nonsense. So, but I getting back to the most important point about this, yeah, I do see a definite opening and much more receptivity to a radical analysis. And I think it's, in a way, it's quite remarkable that already 5 or 6 years ago, half of the people under 30 had a friendly attitude towards socialism, despite all the conditioning of the mass media, which still obtains in this country.
For sure. I wonder if you'll ever be able to get on NPR, or will Terry Gross invite you in for an interview, do you think?
I don't know. I haven't tried. I have a very good publisher. They're very proactive, and I'm going to be on Chris Hedges' program in December, but that's on RT, you know, so that'll fit in with the
Chris
liberal
Hedges
demonization.
Himself doesn't get on the mass media.
Right, yeah.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, what kind of reception have you got for your book among just even amongst, you know, leftist milieus?
Well, so far it's starting off very well. There's a very positive review on the website called Climate and Capitalism, which I run by Ian Angus, an excellent website, by the way. And there are going to be positive reviews in a couple of other publications, and I'm still looking around for more. But in general, so far the reaction has been positive.
And my engineer Heather did get me the address for Rose Villa, where my guest Victor Wallace will be speaking tonight. That's 13505 River Road, and that's in Milwaukee, as you can imagine, right near the Willamette River. And I'll be trying to make it out there. I hope some of you can as well. You've got about 5 minutes left to call in if you want to get a last-ditch comment or question in at 503-231-8187. There's so many things I wanted to go into. I found it, you know, interesting. You really emphasize the politics and technology of eco-socialism, I being, you know, an Earth Firster and somewhat of a Luddite, and you do actually talk about the how kind of Marx took a different turn and sort of basically sort of dismissed the Luddites. Maybe you want to mention that a little bit, but talk about, you know, what some of the issues are around technology and what would, you know, technology look in an actual eco-socialist society.
Well, again, the basic point is always that the choices about technology have to be made on the basis of what's good for people and good for the natural environment. So what I'm arguing against especially is the perpetual tendency of capital, which Marx criticized, to always be looking for new devices just to create a new market. That kind of approach to technology, so ever more refined means of communication, ever more refined weapons, whatever, that without really undertaking a critique. And a lot of these new technologies, I mean, one of the things that I mentioned in particular, and this is a long discussion, it's hard to summarize in a short space, but there's in the discussion now of the environmental issue, there's an overemphasis on differing forms of energy. Because, for example, if you get all the cars to be run on solar cells and batteries, that still leaves a lot of really major problems unsolved. It doesn't address the issue of the amount of materials, the amount of space taken up, and the all the other negative aspects of the automobile-centered transportation system. So a focus just on improving the technology by itself. The technology has to be understood not just as increasingly sophisticated devices and so on. It has to be understood as a whole way of doing things. And so innovation is something I critique the fetish of innovation insofar as it's identified with inventing new devices to do things more quickly or something, and say that where the real innovative thinking is necessary is in the reorganization of the way in which any such devices, including devices that we already have, are now used. So it's not that I'm against technology, but I'm for a human-based technology, not one driven by the requirements of capital.
You know, it's interesting. You talked about your own reaction to automobiles as a young person. I remember clearly that I was terrified in a car, and I think that's a natural reaction because they go too damn fast. Mm. You're familiar with Ivan Illich, probably.
Yeah. Yes.
He had a wonderful essay on in which he argued that socialism will only arrive at the speed of a bicycle. A very sophisticated argument about how if you factor in the amount of time you have to work to buy the automobile, to repair, et cetera, that the time that's spent doing that, you're actually not gaining that much. This whole myth that, you know, we're just caught up in these myths right. that we get conditioned into anyway. So yeah, just the way that technologies, the way that everything just sort of like naturalizes itself into our lives is really frightening, because it just shows how just about anything that can happen with. And the idea that we can actually have any control over, you know, the new iPods coming out, the idea that we can actually control these technologies seems so ridiculous almost, right, to people that talking about it. You know, I mean, I remember, you know, the appropriate technology movement, you know, in the 70s and 80s, right, right. I kind of came out. My formation was a lot in that until I found Earth First. But yeah, I mean, that it's so obvious, but seems so far.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to remember that technologies can be rejected. And there have been experiences of this. I mentioned the supersonic jet transport. Well, that was a technology that developed. They finally rejected it. Ridiculous kind of thing. And well, now nuclear power is, again, it's something that's high tech, and you see the disasters that take place with it. So there has to be a control of technology in a democratic sense, and that should be a kind of obvious point to make. Yeah.
I was wondering if you would indulge me and read a section that I really liked. It's called The Present Moment. Just read from the top of that page, if you would.
Right at the beginning?
Yeah.
The dialectic of oppression and resistance is age old. Marxist thought has disclosed its historical dynamic under the regime of capital, as the critique of capital leads to the idea of the, quote, society of associated producers, unquote, Marx's own term. At first, this idea appears only as a theoretical alternative, although the deficiencies of capitalist rule are already evident. But the longer capital remains entrenched in power, the more it corrupts the process whereby the alternative is generated. We find ourselves in a race against time. Just when the alternative becomes most urgently needed, it also tends to recede from our grasp. Conversely, precisely in the measure that it recedes from our grasp, it becomes even more urgently needed.
Yeah, that I've been struggling with that thought feeling, mm-hmm. and it encapsulates, you know, not perfectly because nothing can capture it perfectly, but it that elusiveness of the situation we're in.
Right. Yeah, it is a race against time, and there has to be an acceleration on our part in the same way that there's been an acceleration of devastation, and that we witness in the environment, and that's pursued by the regime now. So we have to accelerate too to counter all that.
The quickening of the spirit, as a certain tradition talks about.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're almost out of time. I think I where did I write that down now? Rose Villa, you'll be there tonight. So this will be your one and only opportunity for the foreseeable future to listen to, engage with Victor Wallace. And that's at 13505 River Road in Milwaukee, just south of Portland, just down the road along the Willamette River. And he is the author of Red Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism. I hope a bunch of
it's
book reading groups.
7 o'clock this evening, yes,
7
right.
o'clock this evening.
There will be copies of the book there, yeah.
Okay. Well, I encourage people to get a copy and form reading groups around this and many other books like the one that Edie mentioned, Doing Democracy, and so many others. I particularly am really taken by this, so I'd like to get other people's feedback on it. Thank you so much for stopping by, KBOO.
Thank you very much, Paul. It was been a pleasure talking with you.
And me as well. Victor Wallace, Red Green Revolution. And stay tuned for The Politics of Living, featuring stories of women with no prior political experience who've decided to get involved in the upcoming midterm elections. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. And thank you, Heather, our new engineer. Stay tuned.
When you're working two jobs and living in a tent, when a house costs $1 million and you can't pay the rent, when politicians say they'll help but it keeps getting worse each time the landlord lobby pulls the strings of the purse, when the human right to housing is